Last week, a Muslim friend I'd not heard of for 15 years called and left a message, and the timing of his call caught my attention. 35 years ago, my family, my dad, my wife, my brother, we had been sharing our lives and the gospel with this friend, and one Sunday morning, 35 years ago, he sat next to me, and she came to church with us sometimes, and he sat next to me in church, and he looked frightened. So I asked him what was going on, and he told me that the service was about to start, and he said he had a dream the night before, and he was with Jesus, and he tried to go to Jesus to kiss him, and as he approached, Jesus would not allow him to kiss him. He held him at arm's length, and my friend was brokenhearted and frightened by the dream. And that week, I had read Psalms 2, and a part of Psalm 2, it says, "Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in his wrath." So I showed him the verse from one of the Pew Bibles there in the church we were in. And I asked my friend, "In your culture, would you give a kiss of affection to someone you did not know?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, your heart's drawn to Jesus, but your heart's not prepared to surrender to him as Lord, to know him personally." He said in silence. And that friend called me this week. After 15 years, I haven't heard from him. He called me. And it's the same week I was reading Psalms, the same week I was thinking to that very day and that very story. So I didn't think it was coincidental. I don't know where he is. We tried to call him back, haven't reached him yet. But the most common New Testament word for worship is a word that comes from two words put together that mean to kiss towards. And the idea, the background was someone falling at the ground, on the ground before a king or an idol, to kiss the feet or the hand or even the ground in respect and love and worship. So my friend was drawn to Jesus and to the people of Jesus and in his culture to give a kiss to someone you had a relationship with, affectionate with, was not uncommon, but the Lord held him away in his dream because my friend was unwilling to worship Jesus with his life. So we're in Psalms chapter 2. We're not going to go through all 150 Psalms this year. If you do the math, that'd be a long year. We're gonna go through the Psalms 1 and 2, open up the doorway into Psalms, and then we're going to look at some Psalms thematically starting in February. But let me read Psalms 2 start to you. "Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes him in his anger and terrifies him in his wrath, saying, 'I've installed my king on Zion, my holy hill.'" And whenever you read that, that Zion is the mount that the temple was on, and the holy hill, so it's talking about this, often it's talking about the city of Jerusalem and the temple mount and the place where God ruled his people. So you don't have to over-spiritualize that. It has longer-term secondary or ultimate fulfillment in the kingdom that will come, but these psalms were centered in a way of life. "I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." So Psalms 1 and 2 are the introduction to the book as a whole. Psalms 1 asks, what do you want? There are two paths, two loves, two results in a life. Everyone is a lover, and everyone is deciding all the time what love they're going to be developing and furthering. Do you want to walk the way of God or your own way? Psalms 1 is the micro or the personal question of which path. Psalms 2 is the macro or the global version of which path. So we're not just dealing with individual destiny, but with the purposes of God in human history. And this psalm, the genre is called a royal psalm. It's a kingly song, and it speaks of two kings, the human kings of Israel, and then it points forward to the eternal King Jesus. And this psalm was likely used during the coronation ceremonies of Israel's kings, those who followed in the line of King David. As a part of the ceremony, the priests would come out and pour oil on the king's head, and this oil symbolized the divine authorization and empowerment of the office. So that's called anointing with oil. And Jesus in the New Testament is called the Messiah, and the word Messiah means anointed one, God's chosen one. Christ is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word for Messiah, anointed one. And most of Israel's kings did a miserable job of serving as God's anointed leader. In fact, many of them were hypocrites when they used this psalm as a part of their inauguration. It would be like a modern government official who has no intention of paying any attention to the will of God, but includes an invocation at the beginning of their entrance into service. And the prayer invocation would ask for God's blessing and guidance, and even though maybe the one being inaugurated into whatever position has no intention of paying any attention to God. And I've prayed for many military changes of commands over the years, and I'm always wondering, is the person I'm praying for, is this a token prayer to them, or do they really believe they're invoking God's blessing? And more often than not, I will, just in case they aren't paying attention, I'll say, by the way, this is not a token prayer the chaplain's tacking on at the beginning of a service. We're asking God, the God, to invoking his blessing on you and your life. Some took it seriously. Others, I think it was a tradition that had no bearing on how they would lead. And this was the path of most of Israel's kings. Pour the oil, priests, you know, do the token thing so I can get on to doing what I want to do. And even though the kings of Israel were often self-serving, they were living off a promise that God had made to David, a promise that had its ultimate fulfillment in Christ. 2 Samuel 7:16 says, "Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." The kings and leaders of other nations, like Egypt, they often put themselves forward as divine, or even in more modern times, the emperor of Japan was thought to be divine, God. Israel's kings knew they were divine appointments. They didn't think they were God, but they acted functionally as if they were their own God. Some took their role seriously, most didn't. And the real problem for this king promise came during the age of the exile. Israel was split in two by a foolish king around 932 BC, and it became the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, Israel north and Judah south. 200 years later, the northern kingdom fell. 150 years later, the southern kingdom fell. They were weakened by these foolish kings. And during the years of exile, it'd be very difficult for the people to see how the promise of 2 Samuel could be true. We're captive among a people who care nothing of God. Our kingdom is destroyed. We have no king, no nation, no promise. It was their own actions that brought about this catastrophe, but God was using these conquering nations as his tools in shaping human salvation history. And so it was during this time of exile, people began to believe, rightly so, that these promises of this king sitting on a throne had a deeper meaning than simply a man on a throne in Jerusalem. And they began to look for a future Messiah, anointed king. Their perception was the king would be like David, only more powerful. And he would set up a physical kingdom and restore Israel's international status. And so if you think about that, it's no wonder that if you're looking for that kind of a king, that they missed the king when he came. Bethlehem, born to nobody, nowhere. We talked about that at length last year as we went through Mark. So Psalms 2 tells of God's anointed but imperfect human kings, but it points forward to his anointed and perfect Messiah. And so if you look in the New Testament, you'll see Psalms 2 used frequently. At the baptism of Jesus, Paul cites it during a sermon stating that Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of the promises of God. Hebrews uses it to show Jesus is God's son. Acts, the early church leaders, use it to say that those who executed the Messiah were predicted in Psalms 2. Revelation uses Psalm 2 to point to the second coming of Jesus. So the New Testament affirms that this is indeed a royal psalm, but it's pointing forward to the Messiah. So let's look at the psalm. I'm not going to read it again, but let's just go through it kind of piece by piece. Verses 1 to 3 talk about human rebellion, and there's three parallel lines where the author is saying the same thing twice. And basically, the nations and their leaders rebel against the Lord and his anointed king. And we know from earlier discussion, this had meaning for the human kings then and God's anointed king to come, Messiah. Verses 4 to 6, God responds by showing their actions are ridiculous. He laughs, meaning they're not to be taken seriously. He scoffs, meaning they're to be mocked. And the idea is that God's just not worried. He's not wondering if his plans will come to fruition. He's not wondering if these great human kings will defeat him in his ultimate purposes. And if you think just briefly about human history, the nations and leaders who have conspired and plotted against God and his people, Babylonian leaders and Roman empires and Asian rulers and African warlords, Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot and Idi Amin And then Abu Bakr, the ISIS leader. And then I don't want to leave out some of America's leaders who have rebelled against God. History's full of these kind of leaders, and their plans fail. Christians sometimes read the newspaper, and in one hand, and historically in the book of Revelation in the other. And in my opinion, this has led to untold weirdness and even fear. But you should, I think, keep Psalms 2 close by as you read international news, because it gives perspective on current events. You see a leader rise up and plot against the Lord and his people, read Psalms 2. God is not worried. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything when something should be done, but it also doesn't mean that there's a promise that God's people will be kept from being exiled and imprisoned or killed. The Psalms were written during times of exile and imprisonment. Also written during times of Israel's glory. It covered the gamut. But Psalms 2 says, in the midst of all that's around you, see the big picture. God is not worried. In fact, what this evil leader is doing is no joke, but their confidence is a joke. And their short reign will soon become a joke. In fact, often the most feared leaders, whether it's Hitler, Stalin, or some bad local boss you have, when they're gone, they become the subject of jokes. They become bylines. You can look at old cartoons, and you see Hitler, who was this feared tyrant, or Stalin, and they become literally jokes. Think about one of the most fearsome of human leaders and feared. I'll pick Stalin because he was such a wicked fool, responsible for up to 60 million deaths of his own people, many of them because of a famine that he caused in order to wipe out rural people. He would raise his finger and people would die. And so imagine being in the presence of a man like that at the height of his power, and your fate and your children's fate in his hand. He just raises his finger and you're dead. But take a different view of this man. He had an accident at 13 that left him crippled in one arm. He had smallpox that left him insecure about his appearance. In fact, several portrait artists painted his face too realistically, so they were shot. And if you look at the official paintings, they're even back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, they were airbrushed looking. At 5'6", he would stand on steps, so never be below other leaders. My point is not that he was disabled or had scars or was short, but that in addition to being wicked, he was this deeply insecure man. He was a wicked fool who died like one. And during his life, his reign of terror was no laughing matter, but historically he has become a laughing matter. It was, even how he died, it was absolute that no one could come into Stalin's bedchambers. And one time he cried out as in pain, and his guards rushed in. He was testing them and had them shot. So one day he had a paralyzing seizure, cried out, and do you think any guards are going to rush in? I don't think so. And so he was discovered, but he lay there for some time. He died a week later. And so if your life is on the line at the whims of an evil man like this, it's no joke. But from the macro view, this pathetic, insecure man who lived a few years mocking God died a mockery himself. And that's what the great joke is. That's why the psalmist says, the king on the throne in heaven laughs, like Stalin, a few pounds of dirt and water, shaking his fist at the eternal God. It's pathetic. And then verses 7 to 9, you are my son. The speaker here is the king, and he's quoting what God has said to him. He's come into this father-son relationship with God at his inauguration, because the kings of Israel, in the promise of given to David, these men were in an anointed, appointed position as God's leader over the people. And the kings, the line of kings all the way to Jesus, was named after David. David wasn't the first king. He was the first to receive God's promise. So David, who was the first in the line of kings, the great king, failed miserably many times. Adultery, murder, dereliction of duty, and yet he loved God, and God loved him. He's called a man after God's own heart. Others in the lineage of King David were not men after God's own heart, but the difference was not that David was right in all he did and they weren't. The difference seems to be in the orientation of David's heart. A lot of the Psalms were written by David, many of them, so you can see his heart. And he continually came back to God after his failures. And his most famous failure led to one of the most famous and important of all the Psalms. So David was sorry for his sins, but he was clearly sorry that his sins had caused a breach in relationship with God. And he knew he sinned against many people when he took a man's wife and a man's life. But in his prayer to God, he said, "Against you have I, only you have I sinned." And obviously all sin is ultimately against God, but he also knew that his sin was not just against God. This is, in his prayer to God, an expression of how much he knew he'd hurt the heart of God and how much his own heart was hurting over that. And last week we talked about how we're not just brains on a stick, we're primarily lovers, not primarily thinkers. And we orient our lives to what we love. But for all humans, this orientation is about direction, not perfection, because no one apart from God is perfect in their love. And so David's life orientation, just like yours and mine, was a crooked path. But the overall path of his life was towards God. God was like the light, he was like a moth, and he was continually drawn to that light. So I want you to reflect on your own life. I've done that this week, and so this is your chance to think about it. Maybe you have had times of wandering far from God. Maybe right now your heart is far from God. Maybe today is your first step back on that path. And if you measured your life on a given moment, you would conclude, "I don't love God." We could all probably say that. If you look back over last week, some of your less than finest moments, you could probably shake your head and say, "If I look at me right there, I can't say that I love God." But I want you to consider your life over months and years since you came to Christ. If you're a follower of Christ, who does your heart return to over and over and over? If you think about your life, what love are you ultimately drawn to? So if you do indulge your anger, your pride, your lust, and you dishonor God, what happens next for you? For those who don't have a relationship with God, often nothing happens next. But let me tell you what happens to you if you're a follower of Christ. You feel sorrow and shame and sadness and a desire to change. Why is that? And many of you maybe feel like your hearts are so often far from God, but as followers of Christ, our hearts are like homing pigeons. They do wander from home, but their orientation of their hearts is back to God. And so I would say maybe you love God more than you even think you do. How else would you explain your sorrow over your sin? What else would explain the fact that when you feel far from God, you feel lonely and empty? Why is that? Why do you have a desire to change in ways that would please God? Why do you feel despair when you wonder if you will change? Why would it matter? Why would you care so much? Some would say, well, that's human guilt imposed by social norms. And I would say, yeah, you know better. I know better. Someone can say that, but you know, I'm not thinking about social norms. That's a bunch of baloney. What I'm thinking is my heart hurts. Plus, why would we feel bad about what society says is okay? It's because we love God. And your love is there because if you're a believer, you have put your confidence in Jesus, and Jesus has put in you what is in him, and that is love for the Father. And so when Paul says in Romans, we die to sin, how can we live in it any longer? It doesn't mean that we're not going to sin, but it means we have left the kingdom of sin. It's not the dominant factor in our lives anymore. We have a new king and a new kingdom. And so our problem becomes two parts. One is real guilt, and the other is the shadow, the echo of guilt, false guilt. True guilt can be repented of and forgiven and dealt with because of King Jesus. False guilt is this emotion, this echo of real guilt that our own minds and Satan uses to keep us distanced from God. So biblically, if you have real guilt, if you have sin, you repent of the sin and you're done with the guilt. At the same time, though, it's important to refuse to live with the false guilt. It's the shadow of the real thing that no longer exists, but it haunts you and keeps you from experiencing God's love. So look at your life. Look at your longings. It might be more accurate than you realize to say, "I love God." You're not saying you always act like you do. Often we put other loves before him. That's why we have a whole book about getting back on track called the Book of Psalms. But for me at least, to recognize that I do love God is an important part of realizing what's going on inside my heart and my life. I first realized I loved God when I was 19. I've been running from Him for the most part up till that point. And there's other things I've pursued since then that have been miserable failures in terms of imitations of my real love. But my heart is always drawn back to Him. And I would say that if you're a believer, if you really took stock, the same thing's true of you. I knew a little bit about God then. I know a little bit more now. But I loved Him then. And it was clear, and it's become increasingly clear as I've lived my life, that my heart was made for Him. And so David was God's anointed king, and he was a miserable failure in many ways. Yet he was a man after God's own heart. And so as you think about the kings, and you think about this passage, all the human kings, including the great King David, and the deepest longings of your own heart point to this need, this orientation for an eternal king. And not just that one exists, but that we have personal relationship with that king. And that's what verse 10 and 12 lead us to. Kiss the Son. The Son was the anointed king on the day of His coronation. It was the day the human king was anointed. He became the Son of God in the sense that He was God's designated ruler of His people. But this psalm points to Jesus, who is the eternal Son of God. Israel had kings and Israel has priests. The kings were anointed by the priests. The kings dealt with the temporal affairs, the priests with the eternal affairs. Jesus is both priest and king at the same time. So in Hebrews 5:5, it says, "So Christ also did not take upon Himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but God said to Him, 'You are My Son, today I have become your Father.'" And so the author of Hebrews, quoting Psalms 2, this coronation psalm about the king, and he applies it to Jesus becoming our priest, the one who goes to God on our behalf. And so the invitation to come and kiss the Son is to come and worship Him. He is our King, and He is our priest, the one who goes to God on our behalf. So again, there are two paths, the path away from Him into His wrath, the path to Him, where we take refuge in Him and we live His blessed life. So Psalms 1 and 2 tie together this activity of God in individual destiny as well as the nations of the earth. And as humans, we have this capacity to be both far-sighted and near-sighted at the same time. So we have trouble seeing things up close clearly. We have trouble seeing things far off clearly. So Psalms 1 is the lens that allows us to see what's close. Here are the paths before you, all you. All you lovers, here's your choice. There's no neutral choice, no neutral time, no neutral space. Everything we experience, everything we choose, even the choice to not choose, is making us better lovers. And that's really good or that's really bad. But you don't walk every minute of your life. You don't live in neutral space, neutral time, neutral choice. Everything is making us better lovers of something. It's just the way it is. And Psalms 2 is a lens that allows us to see what's far. The same path is before the nations and leaders of nations. God is the God of all the earth through all the ages. Two paths, two destinies, blessing and destruction. So the call is for individuals and for leaders and for nations to worship the true King. But notice that here's how this psalm ends. The next to last word is wrath. The last word is blessed. So all psalms are ultimately invitational. I got to tell you, you people, I think it's nice you read your Bible and do your little prayers and do your touchy-feely group thing. I think it's sweet. And I think youth group is useful. It's good you kids do something wholesome until you grow up and enter the real world and figure out this stuff is not real. And, you know, we all need some moral support in a pinch. You know, it's good to have religion for that sort of thing. Might need a funeral, wedding, a little bit of counseling in a hospital. That's nice. But out where the big boys and girls live, out in the real world, out in the world of money and power and military and companies and thrones and White Houses and Pentagons and CEOs and stars and pipelines, you know, all the really real stuff, not just the religious real stuff. That's life-giving. That's powerful. That's the real stuff. And Psalms 2 says, what a bunch of baloney. That's a joke. This week, here's your homework assignment. Watch world news or read it online or just go through your day and pay attention. And then before you go to bed, read this. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against His anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven's lap. Notice there's no debate here between these kings and God. There's just a laugh from heaven. 2 weeks ago, I was in a room with five men, all over 57. I was the youngest guy in the room. And we spent an evening talking about an hour and a half, talking about how we want to grow older and kinder. We'd like to get older and more loving. We'd like to grow older and know and love God more. We'd like to grow older and be more effective in our work. We don't want to just grow old and put in time. And we spent the evening doing this. Why? Because we believe calling each other to this is an important part of that becoming reality for us. I took in the scene. I was sitting by the fire in my friend's house, listening to my friends talk, and a thought hit me. How many men out there in the world would think this is foolish? Five grown men talking about this silly stuff. What a joke. Then another thought followed. What would those men think is not foolish? So I thought of some things. They wouldn't think it's foolish to spend an evening at a bar talking about a game. They wouldn't think it's foolish to spend an evening at a bar talking about women in ways they shouldn't. They wouldn't think it foolish to fail to choose who they should love and let opportunity slip by as they pursue what won't matter in the end. They wouldn't think that's foolish. They wouldn't think it at all foolish to spend their days plotting and planning how to get more of whatever they want and pay no attention to who and what they're becoming and what that will mean for them in the end. They don't think it foolish to rush headlong into emptiness. So what is the good life? What do you want? What do you love? Psalms 1 says, live small, walk the day-to-day path of God. Psalms 2 says, but as you do that, see the largeness of God. And that's how these two work together. Walk the dirt path of daily life with God and others. That's the good life. At the same time, keep your mind on the largeness of God so your walk on this dirt path won't become disconnected from something big and large. So these two psalms stand as sentries to the book. Psalms 1, walk the small path, step by step. Your feet are made to trod the dirt of earth, real lives, real people in the world God has made. But Psalms 2, but keep your vision large. Your vision was not made for the dirt of earth. Think of the greatness of God. And this parallel way of looking at life and living life is how we see what's real and what's not, what's valuable and what's not. Let's pray. Speak to God and listen to God and respond to God.